Today at Reader's Corner, Peter Brannan, author of The Ends of the World, Volcanic Apocalypses, Lethal Oceans, and Our Quest to Understand Earth's Past Mass Extinctions. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. A handful of times in our planet's history, the vast majority of plant and animal life has gone extinct, leaving a desolate and alien Earth devoid of trees, fish, and familiar signs of life. In the more recent past, scientists have pointed to asteroids to explain some of these extinction events. But today, that view is being questioned. More evidence is pointing towards terrestrial causes of our past extinctions, notably climate and ocean change, spurred by the influx of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. In his book, now out in paperback, The Ends of the World, Volcanic Apocalypses, Lethal Oceans, and Our Quest to Understand Earth's Past Mass Extinctions, Peter Brannan, an award-winning science journalist, pieces together the Earth's five past mass extinctions. Trekking along U.S. highways and digging into rock piles with some of the world's leading paleontologists and geologists, Brannan searches for the smoking gun behind the events that nearly wiped out life on Earth. From the sea without fish, 450 million years ago, to the relatively recent age of the dinosaurs, Peter Brannan looks at each period of life, its end, how each gave rise to our modern world, and how they may offer clues to our stark future. Peter Brannan, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much for having me.
Peter, I was having dinner the other night with some friends, and as they often do, they ask me, well, what's coming up next? And I said, well, I'm interviewing Peter Brannan. He's the author of this book, The Ends of the World. And I gave them some lame attempt on my part to explain your book. I'm hardly the expert. And the first question I got from the group was, how do they know? How do they know that stuff? And so I'd like to start with something that your book isn't really focused on, but how do we know, I guess is the first question, what is it geologists and paleontologists do that allows them to make these incredible discoveries and predictions, look into the past and the future? The companion question, is it a fact that with increasing technology and more power that we have today than ever before, we're able to discover things today and know more about our past than, let's say, we did in the middle of the 20th century. Your thoughts?
Yeah, so that's a great question and a good place to start because it sort of encompasses the entire field of geology, which has been going on since the, you know, for a couple hundred years.
Yeah.
And the reason why we know so much about the history of the planet is this collaborative effort of thousands of people studying disparate rocks all over the planet and compiling it and comparing some rocks to other rocks and aging them based on which fossils are in certain layers and more recently dating them using radioisotopes. So it's this really giant collaborative effort among universities all over the planet that is really this giant puzzle that exists in bits and pieces all over the planet because the fossil record's not perfect. And in any given, you know, section of rock, you're not going to have a complete history of time. So you have to go all over the place to find different representatives of different ages. So that's how we know it. Organizations like the USGS, the U.S. Geological Survey in the U.S., people in universities sort of looking at these maps and going out to exposures and studying things. So it's hard to encapsulate how we came to this body of knowledge. It's sort of like how we know so much about the solar system. It's been this giant effort. And yeah, I think with more technology, we're only going to learn more. So I know in Mexico where they drilled into the middle of the crater in the Yucatan Peninsula where the asteroid hit, the asteroid that is very famous for, you know, wiped out the dinosaurs. And we've just started to see results come back from that where they've modeled exactly what happened when the asteroid hit. And it's just this insane event where, you know, it instantly punctured this hole in the ground that was something like 20 miles deep. And in the next few seconds, it created this 11-mile high mountain of granite and this giant crater that was made of giant mountains. And then after the next few seconds, it sort of all settled down. And so we know the physics now of what happens when you throw a 6 to 7 mile rock at the Earth at 20 times the speed of a bullet. And, you know, they use computers to model exactly how that would have happened. So yeah, I think the more technology that we throw at these questions about how the Earth evolved and these questions about the most important events in Earth history, the more we're learning. I was actually surprised because there's sort of this reputation of natural history and paleontologists as these people who sort of sit in the back rooms of natural history museums and just dust off old bones. But it really is a cutting edge 21st century science where people are using, you know, statistical modeling and isotope geochemistry and all these sort of arcane fields that are helping us piece together what happened in Earth's history.
And of course, I understand that if you're a rock hound, you don't have to go across the planet to find something that would be significant and worthy of study. But I must say, I was a bit taken back, having lived not far from Cincinnati, to learn that, wow, there's a wealth of this stuff right there under Cincinnati. Could you help us understand the extent of that and what's going on there?
Yeah, so that was another one of the motivations of my book, was sort of to illuminate this fact that you don't have to go to the middle of nowhere to look for fossils, that no matter where you are on Earth, if you start to understand the geology of it, there's going to be this amazing story from deep time that the rocks will be telling you. And so, yeah, my dad is from Cincinnati, and I grew up visiting my cousins and aunt and uncle in Cincinnati, and my dad had no idea the rocks there were amazing. And until I started writing this book and I started telling him about it, that it's actually one of the most fossil-rich regions on the Earth. And once you know what you're looking for, you know, you're driving down the highway, coming into the city, and you'll see these outcrops of sort of layered gray rock. And if you pull over, which I don't advise because it can be dangerous on the highway, but if you're careful and you go over and you look at some of these cliffs, you'll see that just falling out of them are seashells. And these seashells are from 450 million years ago. So this is from the late Ordovician period, which is sort of this completely alien planet when Cincinnati would have been, I believe, south of the equator, and North America would have been rotated about 90 degrees on its side. There was almost no life on land on Earth. It would have been a really desolate landscape. But underwater, in these shallow seas that would have covered a lot of North America, and especially in Cincinnati, you had all sorts of life. But it was sort of alien life. It was a lot of things that looked like, you know, like horseshoe crabs, and the top predators were like these squid sort of things that were in these gigantic cone shells. And so it's this totally alien world that's on the side of the highway that if you don't know it's there, you can drive right past it. But if you are fortunate enough, like I was, to join an amateur fossil hunting group, like this group called the Dry Dredgers in Cincinnati, you know, they go out almost every weekend looking for these things. And it's just amazing what you can find there. And the same story can be told almost anywhere you are. So I know even in Idaho, a paper came out a year or two ago about how after the worst mass extinction of all time, there's this surprising sort of blossoming of life in the seas that were in Idaho. So, I mean, these stories are everywhere. You mm-hmm. just have to know how to look for them.
Right. Well, let's talk about the big five mass extinctions, which is the subject of your book. First of all, define an extinction for us.
So just one extinction is when an animal, a lineage, a species goes extinct. But a mass extinction is, it's sort of hazily defined, but it is generally considered to be when the majority of animal life goes extinct in what geologically is a very brief period of time. So on the order of thousands of years, which sounds like a long time to us, but, you know, the long sweep of Earth history, that's basically like a snap of your fingers. So there are really only five that are definitely in this category where over 75% of life goes extinct in a few thousands of years at the most. And the earliest one, it actually happens to this world that I talked about in Cincinnati, where this sort of alien sea world goes extinct, possibly because of an ice age, but we can get into that. But that's what a mass extinction is. The majority of life on Earth goes extinct in a brief period of time. And there's some concern that maybe humans could engineer another one of these in the near future. And so that's why I think the study of this topic is kind of an urgent one.
And what about the issue that I mentioned in the intro, that historically, if we know anything about our distant past, we know about the age of the dinosaur, and we know about the asteroids wiping out the dinosaurs. But your book, in part anyway, in large part, is suggesting that we may be pushing chemistry and temperature, as far as the climate and our ocean systems are concerned, into territory that is not unlike the kinds of territories that might have been problematical in the distant past.
Right. So when people think about mass extinctions, they think about dinosaurs and asteroids. And part of that is because dinosaurs are the most charismatic animals in the fossil record. And they died in this completely spectacular fashion when a giant asteroid hit Mexico. And why people think of mass extinctions that way is because the paper in 1980 announcing that was one of the biggest papers in, you know, the history of geology. And then there were these movies, Armageddon and Deep Impact, that sort of graphically depicted asteroids hitting the planet. And I think for a lot of people, at least in the public imagination, they think, okay, asteroids are mass extinctions are what happens when asteroids hit the planet. And one of the other motivations for the book was that in the 30 years since we've discovered that an asteroid hit when the dinosaurs got wiped out, geologists and paleontologists have sort of gone around the world looking for evidence of asteroid impacts at all the other earlier mass extinctions, these things that aren't quite as famous to most people. And they expected to be able to find craters and layers of essentially asteroid dust in the fossil record, and they couldn't find any of that. And instead, what is tied to a lot of these mass extinctions are these completely mind-boggling volcanic events that are called continental flood basalts or large igneous provinces, where just in one certain part of the world, the Earth sort of turns inside out, and in a few thousand years, an unbelievable amount of lava and magma comes out of the ground. So in the worst mass extinction of all time, it was caused by volcanoes in Siberia that erupted enough lava that it could cover the lower 48 United States a kilometer deep. So these are events that are super rare and way off the charts. But since they only happen in one part of the world, as crazy as that is, it can't be the lava that's killing everything on the entire planet. It's actually thought to be the volcanic gases that come out of these volcanoes. And the gases thought to be most responsible for the mass extinction, there's a couple of them. There's sulfur dioxide, which can cause acid rain. It could also cause brief volcanic winters. But CO2 is actually thought to be the most important gas that comes out of these supervolcanoes, because you can see in the fossil record, it gets really warm for thousands of years afterwards. And the worrying thing, I think, and the news hook sort of for the book, is that we are currently injecting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere at a rate that's, as far as we can tell, 10 times faster than these eruptions that caused the worst things that have ever happened in Earth history. Now, we're not there yet in terms of the level of destruction we've caused, but I think that there's definitely lessons to be learned that maybe shouldn't be meddling with these sorts of forces, given that they've caused so much devastation in the geological past.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Peter Brannan, a science journalist and award-winning author of The Ends of the World. Well, before we leave the culprit, the asteroid, and move on to some of these other things, I do want you to address the work of Peter Ward, who's a University of Washington paleontologist. And toward the end of your book, I believe, you talk about the Hale-Bopp asteroid of 1997, where we might have been just plain lucky.
Yeah, so we know that if the Hale-Bopp had hit Earth, we might be sent back to the age of just bacteria. There might not be any complex life. And so there's this question of why giant comets like this in our past have never hit. And it can start to make you think that Earth is incredibly lucky, and that maybe we should expect Earth-like planets to get wiped out pretty frequently by impacts like that. And this sort of starts to have implications for our search for alien life, which is maybe we are just this completely outlying, almost miraculously lucky planet. And I think that perspective really makes you, A, sort of more thankful and sort of treasure our past and the fact that we're here in the first place, but also makes you realize like what a gift we've been given in this planet, that we have such a head start. We've never, you know, been wiped out, and that stewardship of the planet from that perspective becomes even more important, I think. So I guess that's what I would take from that anecdote.
Somewhere toward the end of your book, you talk about the work that's being done to try to deal with the warming of the planet. And you talk at length about the 2 degrees proposal, the agreement, the Paris Climate Agreement. What's fascinating about that, of course, is not the fact that there was such an agreement. And, of course, almost everyone knows what happened as far as the United States is concerned regarding that. But just how inadequate that is, according to these experts that you've been following around for the time you've written your book.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a couple problems with the Paris agreements. One is that the pledges are all sort of voluntary and there's no enforcement mechanism, so that's a problem. We're also not anywhere near on the path to come anywhere close to 2 degrees. We're on a path of something like 4 degrees warming, and 4 to 5 to 6 degrees warming brings planet Earth back to a period at the very least like 14, 15 million years ago, when it was kind of a totally different planet. There was no ice on Greenland or anything like that. So the current emissions pathway we're on now is pretty concerning, but even 2 degrees, you know, I've talked to a lot of people who think that by the time we get it anywhere near 2 degrees, we'll think that that was a crazy target to even shoot for in the first place, because it's going to be a pretty different planet. There's going to be way more intense storms and heat waves that today are just don't exist. And you'd also, I mean, because the CO2 that we emit, CO2 reacts with seawater to make it more acidic, and there's less carbonate available for animals to make skeletons and shells out of. So there will be widespread ocean acidification, and it'll probably wipe out coral reefs. So it's, I mean, even our target is sort of questionable. You know, it's often said that the people who study this stuff the most are the most concerned. And, you know, I think there's a reason for that. And there's a reason why, you know, people speak in the sort of urgent tones they do, because we sort of do have to change the way we power our civilization pretty quickly, unless we want to jump back into a world that you have to go back millions of years to see in the fossil record.
By the way, let's get one thing clear regarding the movement toward the sixth extinction. This isn't like something, even though we're talking about the warming of the planet, this isn't something that happens tomorrow. And I think in your book, you point out with the help of these experts what the time frame is here if we proceed on this course. I mean, we're all aware that climate is warming, but when it comes to a mass extinction, it's not around the corner.
Right. So there's actually a few different things going on that I think people sometimes equate with one another. And one is sort of how global warming could stress society, which I think is certainly the case. And the other is a biological mass extinction, which is something that is extremely rare in Earth history. And that, you know, so far in the last 400 years, best estimates are that human beings have driven less than 1% of all species extinct on the planet. And when you compare that to the worst things that have ever happened, things like the end-Permian mass extinction, which are 90 to 96% of all species, you know, we have a long way to go. Now, the best paper on this that I'm aware of is this paper written by this guy, Anthony Barnosky, called "Has the Sixth Mass Extinction Arrived?" And I think the way it was reported in the press was sort of yes. And, you know, the paper is much more subtle than that. It says that if we keep up our current rates of extinction, that it's possible we could reach the level of these ancient mass extinctions within a few centuries, which is still kind of crazy given how extreme some of these events are. I mean, in the worst mass extinction ever, the temperature of the ocean was, you know, a jacuzzi over, you know, half the planet. So, you know, these are really extreme outlying events. And the fact that humans are even in the same conversation, it should give us pause. And the other concerning thing is that we don't know if there are any tipping points along the way. So maybe it could be that, you know, we're driving species extinct, but we're not close to the mass extinctions. But then sort of you cause these cascading effects in ecosystems where things start to collapse pretty quickly. And we don't know if there are tipping points like that. So that should give us some humility, too. But I think the way it's often reported is that, you know, the world's already over and like there's nothing we can do about it. And I think that sort of premature obituary for the planet can make people fatalistic, because there's still tons of biodiversity to save and there's still plenty of time to save the world. And I want people to be motivated to do that, not just sort of resign to this, you know, mass extinction that hasn't really even taken place yet, but could if we don't change our behavior.
So tell us about the exercise in Puerto Rico called the Motivated Point Man, which really helps us understand, to your first point, that global warming definitely affects society and affects people, and it will do so increasingly over coming years. Help us understand that episode.
Yeah, so this was given to me by Matt Huber, who's a climate scientist at UNH, and I think he works at Purdue a little bit too. But he was trying to explain how, again, how network effects can cause rapid collapses pretty quickly in society. So some people think that mass extinctions and sort of power grid failures might play out the same way, where, you know, some glitch in a control room in Ohio can cause the whole Eastern Seaboard to black out. And, you know, it's hard to understand why until you start to understand these network effects where you take out this one sort of keystone and sort of the whole thing comes down. And his anecdote was about, so he was trying to project if society could deal with warming in the future. And he was quite pessimistic about this. And he, as an anecdote, he described this, I believe, as an army exercise in, I think, Puerto Rico, where, you know, it was exceptionally warm and hot. And the exercise was to go hiking deep into the jungle. And pretty quickly, the group leader was overcome by heat stress. These were incredibly fit, cream of the crop military guys. And, you know, once the temperature gets above a certain point, the human body just can't cool off anymore. And you start to get hyperthermal and heat stress. And so the group leader started to get heat stress. And then his underlings sort of tried to relieve him of his duty, and they had to carry this guy. But then they were so stressed because of the extra exercise that was incurred by having to carry this guy in the jungle. And, you know, in a very short time, these incredibly elite, this incredibly elite group of, you know, military experts were unable to fulfill this mission and were almost all collapsing of heat stress. And they had to get rescued because it was getting out of control so quickly. So the moral of that is that when you start taking out these integral parts of society or communities, and you place more stress on other people, and in the background, you're increasing the background conditions of heat and humidity and things like that, that, you know, maybe this could be an analogy for how our society could respond to increased warming. So it was a pretty, I don't know, gloomy peek into the future when I was talking to him.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Peter Brannon, an award-winning science journalist and author of The Ends of the World. In the book, Brannon pieces together Earth's five past mass extinctions, how each gave rise to our modern world, and how they may offer clues to our own future on Earth. Well, I think he's the same guy, this Matthew Huber from the University of New Hampshire, who you also engaged in a conversation about where is it going to get the hottest and where is it going to stay the coolest. And he talks about the Midwest. And then you get into this conversation with him about where you should buy real estate down the road so you don't get so hot. And I think you might have thought he was kidding, but I'll let you tell the rest of the story.
Yeah, so I made a joke that I'd been to Newfoundland recently, and I was like, oh, I guess I should get a place in Newfoundland. And, you know, just he didn't miss a beat, and he just said, yeah, that's a good idea. Anywhere north of, you know, 40 degrees latitude, and said he was looking into somewhere in New Zealand. But, you know, these are worst case scenarios, and this doesn't have to happen. But yeah, I mean, I think one of the most underrated parts about warming, sort of strangely, is the warming itself. You know, we talk a lot about sea level rise, but it could be that ice sheets and glaciers actually take a long time to melt. And so, yeah, it'll be bad for some coastal cities, but heat stress and the addition of humidity and high temperature by the end of the century really could dwarf sea level rise in terms of the amount of the planet that it makes, you know, unsuitable for humans, because we need to be able to cool off. And at a certain temperature and humidity, it's called the wet bulb temperature, measures this. If you get above 35 degrees Celsius in a wet bulb temperature, humans just can't sort of survive in that environment. And he wrote this paper where him and a colleague plotted out, you know, what parts of the planet will start to exceed that temperature with different degrees of warming. And, you know, the path we're on at 4°C, there's significant portions of heavily populated areas of the planet that just become unsuitable for humanity. So, I mean, there's already geopolitical risk we see with the Middle East and mass migration and things like that. But that will only get worse if we stay on a business as usual emission scenario. And a lot of sub-Saharan Africa and a lot of South America. And yeah, even the Midwest will get really, I mean, I'm sure you know how hot and sticky it can get in the summer sometimes. And you know, crank that up a little bit more and it starts to get beyond just uncomfortable. It gets to be, you know, intolerable. So if we don't change what we're doing, that's where we're headed.
So one of the things I really enjoyed about your book is the way you would take us into the distant past and help us understand how we're actually using it today. And what comes to mind is the shale gas revolution, where oil companies are doing all this fracking. Tie that to our distant past, if you will, Peter.
Yeah, so I was amazed to learn that most of the natural gas that we frack, at least in, you know, New York, Pennsylvania, the Dakotas, that is mostly from dead sea life that died in the Devonian mass extinction. So these are crises that happened the Devonian's weird because there's actually about 10 extinction pulses from 385 or something to 359 million years ago. But so again, the North America was covered in shallow seas, which sort of you got to wrap your mind around to understand these things. And these shallow seas would continually lose their oxygen and everything in them would die. And that dead sea life, you know, life is made out of carbon. So that dead sea life fell to the bottom of the seafloor and over millions of years became the sort of carbon that we put in our cars and trucks. Yeah, I thought that was just fascinating that, you know, we're using the remnants of this past mass extinction to burn in our modern society and sort of radically change our own environment.
So set the stage for the current period we reside in. We're in the Holocene period, in a glacial or interglacial period, depending on which expert you talk to, I guess.
Yeah, so we're sort of in an unusual period of Earth history in that for most of the history of animal life, there hasn't been ice at the poles. And starting about 35 million years ago, Antarctica glaciated, and then starting about 3 million years ago, the Arctic joined up. And for the past 2.8 or so million years, we've been going in and out of these massive ice ages, and we're actually still in the ice age. And you can tell that because there's ice on Antarctica and there's ice on Greenland and in the Arctic Ocean. And, you know, the ice ages haven't gone away. They've just sort of retreated in these things called interglacials, which we go in and out of glacial and interglacial periods about every 100,000 years. So we're in this brief, pleasant period of warmth. And if humans weren't here, we should expect to have maybe already gone back into an ice age where, you know, I think there would be ice over you in Idaho, and certainly where I am in Maine right now, there would be something like almost a mile or something of ice. And so that should probably be in our future if it wasn't for us. Now, it's a good thing that we've delayed the ice age, because that wouldn't be a world that we'd want to live in. The risk is that we could make a world so warm that we go back to, you know, the time I was talking about 35, 36 million years ago, where it was so warm that there was no ice on Antarctica. And the projection is we'll get to that level of warming in CO2. Not that Antarctica will disappear tomorrow, but we're definitely kicking the planet back into some really deep geological history.
Absolutely amazing. I'd like to go back to the age of the dinosaurs just one more time and talk a little bit about the Cretaceous period. We know the asteroid struck. We know it was 6 miles long. We know that it wiped out the dinosaur and much of planet Earth as we know it, I guess. The question I have is what was, in fact, left? And how can you help us understand what the planet looked like after that last mass extinction?
Well, it's hard to even imagine how bleak things were, certainly in the immediate moments after the mass extinction, where some people would say that the whole planet was basically broiled. And then there was so much dust left in the atmosphere that, you know, photosynthesis might have shut down in the decade afterwards or so. And then the asteroid itself would have evaporated so much carbonate rocks where it hit in Mexico that it would have unleashed tons of CO2. But then at the same time, the other side of the planet in India, you have these volcanoes called the Deccan Traps that could have covered the lower 48 states and 600 feet deep of lava at the exact same time. And they would have been shooting tons of carbon dioxide and sulfur dioxide into the air. And so they would have been doing almost the exact same thing as the asteroid. And so I can't even imagine what the first few decades of life after dinosaurs were like. They would have been just unbelievably bleak. But then in the immediate aftermath of that, I actually went out to New Mexico with some paleontologists, and we were looking for fossils right after the dinosaurs went extinct. And it's amazing how resilient life is. And that's another one of the messages of the book is, in the long run, planet Earth is going to be fine. It's seen much worse than us, because even after these crazy events, almost immediately life is able to bounce back. And just sort of this whole new world blooms. Interestingly, though, after the dinosaur extinction, we have birds, which are, you know, our dinosaurs. They are a lineage of dinosaurs, and they sort of take over some of the niches that were abandoned by dinosaurs. So in the past 60 million years, we've had these giant terror birds, they're called, that, you know, look like velociraptors, basically, only with feathers. Although velociraptors probably had feathers too. So yeah, I mean, we live in a mammal world now, although we still have birds, and birds are more diverse than mammals. So you could actually argue that we still live in the age of dinosaurs in a way. But yeah, with every mass extinction comes new opportunities for some lineage that's able to make it through. And we just so happen to be lucky enough to be the one that lived in the wake of the age of dinosaurs.
Peter, that's a great way to wrap it up. I want to thank you for being on Reader's Corner today. Again, the name of the book, The Ends of the World, Volcanic Apocalypses, Lethal Oceans, and Our Quest to Understand Earth's Past Mass Extinctions. Peter, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much for having me.
Next week, author Amor Towles talks with us about his best-selling novel, A Gentleman in Moscow. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Custer. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.